Welcome to Speak Up and Stay Alive Radio with author, speaker, and your host, Pat Rulo. Serving you a generous helping of everything you need to know to help you and your loved ones stay safe during any doctor or hospital visit. The program is not intended to replace medical advice from a licensed professional, but rather to encourage you to become a well-informed participant in your health and well-being. And now, your host, Pat Rulo.
You're listening to Speak Up and Stay Alive, Patient Safety Radio, and I am your hostess, Pat Rulo, always bringing you healthcare-related news and views that you can use. And today, we are going to set the record straight about the diagnosis and treatment of adult ADHD, Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder, with our guest, global ADHD expert Dr. Stephen Ferrone, Distinguished Professor of Psychiatry and Neuroscience and Physiology at SUNY Upstate Medical University. And after today's program, you can find out more at the website ADHDinAdults.com. And I am pleased to introduce him to you. So welcome to the show, Steve.
Thank you, Pat. Happy to be here.
Good. I've got so much to ask you today. I'm excited to get started. Let's give our listeners, if they're not familiar with ADHD, just give us a brief overview as to what that is and then what the difference is, if any, when we talk about adult ADHD.
Sure. Yeah, ADHD, Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder, is a disorder, as its name indicates, of motor hyperactivity. In childhood, you have kids that run around a lot, climb on furniture. Impulsivity, acting without thinking, the child that runs into the street after a ball, the adult that makes a right-hand turn but doesn't check for incoming traffic, and inattention, simply not paying attention. Also, not being organized in one's own thoughts, not paying attention to one's own thoughts, and being able to self-regulate one's own behavior. Mm-hmm. We like to talk about ADHD as a disorder of self-regulation, the inability to regulate our motor activity, the inability to regulate our attention, and the inability to regulate our impulses. In adulthood, we see some changes in the symptoms. So adults with ADHD aren't running around like hyperactive children and climbing on furniture. Instead, they have a sense of an inability to sit still. The adult with ADHD doesn't like to be, for example, in meetings or sitting down at the computer all day long. They're more likely to get up and pace around and fidget. They're more likely to express discomfort if they have to be in a situation where staying seated is required. But we do see a diminution then of the symptoms of hyperactivity, and they're more likely to show symptoms of inattention and even some diminution of the symptoms of impulsivity as well. But the disorder is the same disorder, it's just a little bit of a morphing of how the symptoms look in adulthood.
Right, right. Now I remember when it used to be called ADD. When and why was the hyperactivity component added?
That's a good question. So it actually had been called hyperkinetic disorder of childhood in the 1960s. And which was emphasizing the hyperactivity. And then in the 1980s, when we came out with our first well-defined, well-structured criteria, it was called attention deficit disorder, or ADD. And what happened between roughly 1980 and the early 90s is we realized that by calling it ADD, it had underemphasized the symptoms of hyperactivity. And so the H was added back into the name because even with the 1980s definition, you could be defined as ADD with or without hyperactivity. So the H was actually there, but it was sort of hidden. Mm-hmm. And a decision was made by the committees that make these decisions to change the name to ADHD. The actual disorder, of course, didn't change.
Right.
It was just the way it was named by the so-called diagnostic committee.
When most people hear about ADHD, as you mentioned, they think of children or young adults, but no one really considers that these people are going to grow up to be adults and the ADHD doesn't just disappear.
That's absolutely right. There was, in the 60s and 70s, there was this total myth that ADHD disappeared into adolescence and into adulthood. That carried through even into the 80s, even to the early 90s. If you were an adult with ADHD, you had a hard time finding a place to get treated. And many adults with ADHD were actually treated by child psychiatrists. Mm-hmm. Because the child psychiatrists would have their kids grow up, become adults, and they would treat them because they couldn't get treated. They literally wouldn't be treated by their primary care doctors because their primary care doctors as adults never got trained in adult ADHD. So it was a very, very tough time up until really even the beginning of the 21st century, it first started to get accepted in primary care that adults could have ADHD. And even then, when it was accepted, it was not widely accepted because most doctors didn't even know about adult ADHD, which is why we launched our website, ADHDinAdults.com, to train primary care professionals, doctors, nurses, physicians, assistants on how to recognize and diagnose and treat adult ADHD.
Mm-hmm. And it's a very rich website, ADHDinAdults.com. If an adult was not diagnosed as a child, how confusing then as an adult for those who live with this person, they really don't understand what's going on, nor do they know how to deal with that behavior.
Well, you raise a very good point, and one of the obstacles for adults getting appropriately diagnosed is just that, that they were not diagnosed by their pediatrician or a psychiatrist in childhood. And so as they're in adulthood and they seem to have these symptoms, the doctor doesn't really know what to do with it. Now, one of the issues that we try to point out to physicians and we train them is that many adults who come in without having had a childhood diagnosis, if you do a careful childhood history, you'll find those symptoms of ADHD in their childhood. And sometimes they will have actually met the criteria for the diagnosis but never been diagnosed because of a mistake by their pediatrician or because the parent didn't know enough to bring them in for a diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
In other cases, you have what we call people who grow up with a lot of social, emotional, psychological scaffolding. They have a lot of protection around them. That could be parents who are really super parents, teachers who are very well-structured. It could also be a child who has high intelligence, so they have high internal resources, and they can cope with their ADHD or most of their ADHD while they are children or adolescents. When they enter adulthood, the stresses of life increase dramatically. The challenges to their, what we call their executive functions of the brain, increase dramatically, and they begin to fall apart. It could be, for example, a woman has her first child and has to deal with childbearing and taking care of kids, which is incredibly complicated. That's not unusual to see somebody come in for an ADHD diagnosis at that point, at that particular life event. It could be someone having a new job that just requires a lot of self-organization, which they don't have. So there are a lot of good reasons why an ADHD diagnosis may seem like it emerges in adulthood, but actually was there all along.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. You talk about the scaffolding as a child, and I would imagine then as you get older, out into the real world, that scaffolding disappears, and there you are, left with this behavior that you don't understand. So how is it diagnosed is part A of my question, and B, then who is best equipped to do this diagnosis?
So it's diagnosed by a clinician. This could be a psychologist, it could be a child psychiatrist, it could be a pediatrician, it could be a primary care doctor, a clinician who is using the official diagnostic criteria of the American Psychiatric Association, which are known as the DSM-5 now, for the fifth edition. A DSM means Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. And it's a very well-defined set of criteria. In fact, you hear sometimes in the news media that, ADHD is a subjective diagnosis, and it really depends on who's making it, and there's no clear definition of it. It's absolutely not true. The definition is extremely clear. You have 18 symptoms which you ask of the patient or the patient's spouse or the patient's parent, and you document that these symptoms occur. You have to have enough of the symptoms to occur. And you also document that the symptoms are causing impairment in the person's life. And typically, I shouldn't say typically, but they cause impairment in more than one setting. So it's not simply ADHD being limited to the patient's life at home. It has to affect them at home, it has to affect them in the workplace, at least two settings. ADHD is not a venue-limited disorder. If it occurs at home, it's got to occur in the workplace. Mm-hmm. It's got to occur with friendships because it's a pervasive disorder. And it's also a chronic disorder. It's not a disorder that comes in episodes where you have a fit of ADHD for a few weeks, then it goes away and you have another fit of ADHD. No, it's a chronic disorder. It's always there. It may fluctuate a bit, but if it doesn't show that kind of chronic course, then it's not ADHD, and the doctor would look for another disorder.
Mm-hmm. Now, you have a screening assessment it's not a diagnostic tool, but it is a place to start, and you have that on your website. Just share that with us for a moment.
Yeah, we do. I'm glad you brought that up because particularly in the primary care setting, when doctors are trying to figure out who amongst their hundreds of patients should they consider a diagnosis for, it's useful to have a tool that says, here's who you should be worried about. It's also a useful tool for people who think they might be themselves concerned about their own ADHD, whether it's ADHD in their spouse, to ask to be screened with this tool. It's called the Adult Self-Report Scale, and it's simply a series of questions that ask the questions, the same questions a doctor would ask about these DSM-5 criteria for ADHD, only it's done on a rate, what we call a rating scale. So question will be rated as on a scale of 1 to 4, 1 meaning that this doesn't bother me at all, or 4 meaning this happens a lot in my life. And by rating these symptoms, we basically tally up the symptoms, and when a person meets a certain threshold, we say, this is somebody who we should be worried about, it might have ADHD, but we don't say they have ADHD because the diagnosis can only be made by a doctor going through the criteria and making sure that they're actually there and they cause impairment. I also didn't mention that part of the diagnostic criteria is that the disorder has onset prior to the age of 12.
Interesting. So you're saying that it typically manifests itself before age 12. So I guess if people are aware, they can diagnose this early and save that person a lot of headache, as well as the people who are surrounded by this person.
Well, that is very true. I mean, I like to say when I teach physicians about ADHD that if you diagnose early, you're actually preventing lots and lots of problems.
Mm-hmm.
Because if a child is not diagnosed, then it impairs them in school with their friends. If an adolescent is not diagnosed, it causes the same problems. It makes the transition to adulthood difficult. If an adult has ADHD and has been missed all these years and they're not diagnosed, it predicts a worse outcome for them in the future. Mm-hmm. We know, for example, now we have lots of studies, these long-term follow-up studies of ADHD. Yeah, so now we know what happens to people over time and what are the effects of the medication treatments we have for ADHD.
Mm-hmm.
There's a number of studies, for example, that show if you look at a long-term follow-up of these children into adulthood, the kids who are treated appropriately over time are less likely to develop substance use disorders. They're less likely to develop criminality, less likely to develop depression. So there's a real risk for not treating these disorders and not finding them earlier in life.
Mm-hmm. And that kind of takes me to my next question, is that this obviously doesn't occur in a vacuum, that there are other disorders involved, such as depression or anxiety.
Yes, and that's one of the problems with making the diagnosis, is confusing it with other diagnoses that the person might have. So we know that ADHD people are at risk for other disorders. You mentioned depression and anxiety. They're also at a higher risk for having bipolar disorder, which is a more serious mood disorder, typically, than depression. These other disorders sometimes are more salient and are sometimes the reason why an adult comes in for treatment. Now, this is a little bit different than in childhood. So in childhood, typically ADHD onsets first, then these other disorders come later. So in pediatricians, we say, a kid has ADHD, that's somebody you should just monitor over time and make sure they're not developing another problem. And if they're developing it, treat that early. But for the adults, what happens is that the adult with ADHD frequently doesn't see their ADHD as necessarily a problem. But when they get depressed, they see that as a problem. They get anxious, they see that as a problem. So they go into their primary care doctor, they get treated for that because the primary care docs are very comfortable with those diagnoses. They've treated them for many years. And they don't even think about ADHD because they don't know about it. In fact, one of the tips we give people at our website, tips that we give doctors at our website, is that if you think you don't have ADHD in your practice, take a look at everybody who has a depression or anxiety disorder, especially those who aren't doing well on their antidepressants or their anti-anxiety drugs. We guarantee you will find people with ADHD that are not treated.
Wow.
But I should emphasize that it's not an issue of the ADHD causing the depression or the depression causing ADHD. These are independent disorders that for biological reasons go together. That's something researchers are doing a lot of work on to understand why that happens. But the doctor shouldn't be thinking it has to be one or the other. Having two disorders, we now know from many hundreds of studies, both in the population and in the clinic, that if you have one psychiatric disorder, your odds of having another one are greatly increased. So it's actually fairly normal for a person to have two psychiatric disorders, or even three, once they have their first disorder.
I was reading about how ADHD, especially in adults, costs society more than $100 million annually in lost work productivity, accidents, hospitalizations, and healthcare costs. And I was going to ask the question why, but because these other disorders are involved, that kind of answers that question, yes?
Yeah, and ADHD people are at a greater risk for having all sorts of accidents, including traffic accidents. That increases healthcare costs dramatically, for sure. And you know that when they're treated with medication, that reduces, well, improves their driving skills, and it reduces all kinds of accidents in across the board from childhood through. And also we're discovering, this is relatively new data, but we're discussing that people with ADHD are at higher risk for some other medical conditions, such as diabetes, such as hypertension. Those are the two that are coming out. Asthma is another good example where it's pretty well documented now. That people with ADHD have a high risk for asthma. And so we don't understand the underlying biology of that or whether it's due to simple behavior. So another comorbidity, as we call it, has to do with obesity. People with ADHD are more likely to be obese. Mm-hmm. That could be due to poor impulse control, mm-hmm. eating too much, or it could be an underlying biological connection that's being explored by myself, actually, and some other folks. So all of these, this constellation of traits leads them, in fact, and not to frighten people with ADHD, but there is a very small but real increased risk for premature death. The people with ADHD will tend to die a little bit younger than people without ADHD because of accidents and these other medical morbidities that they have.
Mm-hmm. So as a person who lives with another who has ADHD, are there any ways to help? Are there any triggers that one should avoid? What can one do?
One thing that would be very important would be to help the person with ADHD around issues of self-organization. That there are little tricks that we all use to organize our lives better. We have planners, we have calendars, we use our cell phone to organize ourselves. People with ADHD need to do that more than the average person, and they need to remember to do it. That's one of the biggest problems, remembering to do what you're supposed to do. So, you know, having lists of things that you should do, having reminders of the important methods that you have for regulating your own behavior. Again, we call that self-regulation, being in charge of yourself. You have to be much more mindful of that than the average person. Things that you would take for granted that, for example, getting ready for the day in the morning, you know you have to do a sequence of things and you always do them. A person with ADHD might have to have a little list into the mirror to remind them to do that. It depends on what exactly they tend to forget or where their disorganization is worse. It can be helpful. A spouse, for example, can help another spouse by helping them recognize when they're taking on something which maybe is a little bit too much for their organizational capacity, or which means they need to have some kind of support for that particular project. I think that's very important. It could be certain times people are making life decisions about moving from one career to another career. And there are careers which are not great for ADHD people because it makes them have to, like, for example, sit in front of a computer all day. That's not the best job for a person with ADHD. If the spouse can help their ADHD spouse think through those issues, that would go a long way to helping them cope with their ADHD. Mm-hmm. Not to mention that helping them maintain their treatment program, because one of the biggest problem we have with treating people with ADHD is not that we don't have good medication or good cognitive behavior therapy, it's that patients don't follow through with the treatment. It is the non-adherence to treatment is the biggest problem we have. That's, well, probably second in adult ADHD, it's second to not identifying patients in the clinic. Mm-hmm. Once they're identified and treated, the amount of non-adherence to treatment is huge. Absolutely. Half the people will stop taking their medication very quickly after they've been prescribed it.
And probably most likely because by adulthood, a person probably thinks that they've developed some strategies to manage some of their challenges and think, well, I don't really need the medication for that.
Well, that's true. There's often the belief also that It's a sign of weakness if you have to take medication, so they don't like the idea that they have to have this crutch for medication. There are some times when the medication doesn't, it changes the way their emotions feel. Some people feel that their emotions are kind of dulled. Mm-hmm. They don't enjoy life as much on the medication. If that happens, that can be fixed. The doctor can adjust the dose. They can choose a different medication. There are many choices now, so that shouldn't really be an issue. But really, it's any ADHD person who is not taking their medication needs some kind of support from a helper in the family, be that a spouse or someone else, who can give them the support and the knowledge that they might need to help them to continue to take that medication, mm-hmm. Or to make changes in the medication regime by talking to their physician about it.
And that's why I think this is an extremely important conversation, not just for the person who has adult ADHD, but for those who either live or work with others to help them identify perhaps that their partner or someone, their coworker, has this, and it just gives everybody a better way to cope. So now we're talking about the most effective way to treat adult ADHD is through medication and cognitive behavior therapy?
Cognitive behavior therapy is only indicated for someone who is taking medication. All the tests of CBT, as we call it, cognitive behavior therapy, all the tests that have been done that show that it works, show that it works in the context of taking medication.
Okay.
If you're taking medication and you also have CBT, you do better than if you just take medication alone.
All right.
So the standard treatment the standard treatment for anyone with ADHD is to start with medication and get that straightened out first, because in fact, we should talk about that a little bit, because a lot of people don't understand the process of fine-tuning a medication for a psychiatric problem.
All right.
Like ADHD. They're kind of expecting, oh, the doctor will give me medication, I'll be okay, and that's that. But what happens really is that the doctor has to use a lot of trial and error to get the right medication at the right dose. When that happens, it's not that your doctor doesn't know what they're doing, it's just that it's the nature of our level of understanding. We have, there's a handful of medications that we have. We know that they work really well, but they don't always work the same for everybody. And so you have to start somewhere. If that doesn't work, you go somewhere else. Some patients get very frustrated because they say, oh, my doctor, he's tried me on 3 medications already. I'm going to give up. This doesn't make sense. He doesn't know what he's doing. That's wrong. He actually does know what he's doing. He's just trying to get you to the right place and at the right dose. So patients have to avoid the sense of frustration that they might feel about that. But getting back to your question, we know when the medications have been very well tested on many clinical studies. We're talking here about medications FDA approved for ADHD. There are 2 major classes. You have your stimulant medication, and those include methylphenidate and amphetamine, better known as Ritalin and Adderall. And we have your non-stimulant medications, which are essentially, we have 3 now. There's atomoxetine, known as Strattera, guanfacine, known as Intuniv, and clonidine, known as Keppex. Now, the big difference, or the big choice point in an ADHD medication is stimulant versus non-stimulant. Do you go Ritalin, Adderall, or do you choose one of the other non-stimulants? Usually, a doctor will go with a stimulant first because they're more effective. They may be about a third more effective than a non-stimulant on average. So it's a good place to start just because they're the greater efficacy. Mm-hmm. There's sometimes when a doctor won't go there first because maybe they're worried about possible issues with substance abuse, and stimulants could be potentially abusable, and so therefore they keep away from that patient away from the stimulants. But otherwise, they would start with a stimulant first. But they really don't know. There's no information say whether they start with methylphenidate or amphetamine. Do you go with Ritalin first or Adderall first? No one really knows how to choose one versus the other for the most part. They make a guess, and if that doesn't work, they try the next one.
Mm-hmm.
But patients shouldn't be frustrated by trial and error. It's just required by the nature of the problem.
And hopefully there's a good dialogue and transparency between the doctor and patients so they can all understand that it is a trial and error, and that both have to cooperate to achieve that final result, rather than just say, hey, take this. And, as you said, then the patient thinks, well, he or she doesn't know what he's talking about. I'm not going to take them anymore. So I really think that that openness and the dialogue and the conversation is pretty key with this. And when you mentioned stimulants, I thought, wow, that sounds kind of counterintuitive to give somebody who's already fidgeting and to give them a stimulant, but interesting.
Yeah, well, it was called for many years the paradoxical effect that, you know, kids were moving around too fast and the stimulant slowed them down.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one way we like to describe that is that it's slowing down the part of the brain that's making them go too fast.
Mm-hmm.
But it actually has more of a direct effect in the brain where it's amazing the kinds of studies that can be done now, but you literally can image the brain of an adult while they're taking medication, and you can show that the medication is going to a certain part of the brain called striatum, and it is blocking a protein in the striatum called the dopamine transporter. And we believe by blocking this transporter, it's improving the signaling of this neurochemical called dopamine in the brain, and that's what is helping ADHD people be able to regulate their behavior
mm-hmm.
better. So it's not really, it doesn't really slow them down. ADHD is not a problem of moving too fast. It's a problem of not regulating behavior.
Mm-hmm.
That it's an important concept, self-regulation, because it helps the patient and also the spouse or the partner consider how can we do a better job of regulating the person with ADHD.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it helps if that self-regulation comes from the outside. It can become from the partner who is not in charge of the ADHD adult, but can help them develop methods for self-regulation.
Right.
Or it can come from outside aids, such as a cell phone or something else that helps the person get organized. That
mm-hmm.
you can sort of help regulate yourself by using tools that are available to you.
Right. So it's really not something that can be cured, but rather managed.
Absolutely. There's no cure. It is true that we were talking before about how symptoms change over time. By adulthood, approximately a third of children will more or less grow out of their ADHD. It's very hard to find. It's hard to find any symptoms of them at all. Two-thirds continue to have impairing signs of the disorder. So in some cases, the disorder does go away. It's not because it was cured. We just think that there's some people have a type of ADHD that naturally goes away. Some interesting studies that suggest that it has to do with brain maturation.
Mm-hmm.
And people whose ADHD goes away, their brains tend to normalize over time compared to people whose ADHD does not go away.
Oh. Are there any other alternative ways that people look to solve this situation?
There are many alternative treatments that are offered on the internet and by other methods to tell adults with ADHD that they can improve their ADHD by taking this vitamin or using this computer program or using a fidget spinner. Even people have talked about that as a way to treat ADHD. For the most part, these methods have not been tested. When they've been tested, there's no method that's a non-pharmacologic method. With one exception, there's no method that's been shown to have a strong effect on ADHD symptoms in the absence of medication. Now, the exception has to do with omega-3 therapy. It's not really a therapy, it's a
mm-hmm.
nutrient. But there are data that show that if you treat ADHD with omega-3 tablets that are, it's a specific type of tablet that's stronger in the EPA than in the DHA type of omega-3, that does improve ADHD symptoms, but not anywhere nearly as good as medication. So, for example, on a scale of 1 to 10, if ADHD medication is a 9, the omega-3 therapy is more like a 2 or 3. So that means it's really not going to be a very useful therapy for most people, but it's at least one that's been tested. And if you really need to try something before a medication, you might try that. But I really would warn people not to spend years trying out every possible non-medical treatment in the hopes that you'll find one. Because every month of wasted treatment is a problem, because it leads to more ADHD symptoms, more problems in one's life. And those eventually accumulate, and it makes it more difficult to reverse when you finally do get
mm-hmm.
a good treatment. So, unfortunately, and this, I shouldn't say that these treatments will always be ineffective. There's a lot of work now, for example, on looking at mindfulness-oriented therapies as being able to treat adult ADHD. The jury's still out on that. There's a lot of work being done right now looking at physical exercise, potentially mitigating ADHD. But still, the jury's out on that. And I edited a book about this 2 years ago, and there's a lot of work being done, but still no one's come up with the magic sauce, if you will, to put together a program of exercise and diet that is going to be substantially helpful to people that have ADHD. Beyond saying, of course, that good diet and good exercise is good for everybody, so certainly ADHD people should do that, but they shouldn't expect that it's going to have a dramatic effect on their symptoms and the impairments that they're having.
Oh, that's interesting. When you talk about mindfulness and doing things perhaps like yoga or Tai Chi, just to center oneself, I imagine that wouldn't hurt.
Exactly. It wouldn't hurt. It only hurts if it's being done instead of an effective treatment, because what we know from, what we know from drug studies, I've showed you before, that, well, drugs work, meaning that you improve more if you're in the drug group versus the placebo group. But we also know from drug studies that if you're in the placebo group, you're more likely to get worse than if you're in the drug group. So there's a risk. People don't understand there's a risk for not taking a treatment, not taking an effective treatment. And the risk is that you will get worse. Mm-hmm. And you expose yourself to more problems that may not be easy to turn back, especially if that happens for a long period of time.
Right.
I remember, I'll give you just a case where a good friend of mine said to me, he says, you know, he says, my daughter has a kid that I'm pretty sure has ADHD, and she keeps going to find every possible non-medical treatment. She's been doing this for 4 years now, and it's getting nowhere. The kid's just getting worse. Would you mind talking to her? Maybe you can make an impact on her. So I had a conversation with this young lady, and I just basically said to her, gave her the facts about medications in terms of their efficacy and the potential for adverse effects. And I also said to her, you know, I guarantee you, you can try it just a few weeks. You don't have to sign on for the rest of your son's life. You try it for a few weeks and just see what you think. Well, make a long story short, he tried it, called him back after 2 weeks, and he says, oh my God, I should have talked to you 4 years ago. He's so different. He is so much better. He is, it's amazing what a difference it makes. Effective medical treatment can be a life-saving treatment for people. And it really is a life-saving treatment because the disorder can lead to a very difficult time for many people. So I can't emphasize that it's dangerous to try ineffective treatments because you're not letting yourself be treated with the effective one. And that's the biggest problem with the ineffective treatment.
Right. Well, great. I think that point is well taken, that to get diagnosed early and to find the effective treatment and to stick with it. As you're saying that, I'm wondering, as an adult with ADHD, as an adult ages, and then perhaps meets with some level of cognitive decline, does the disorder then diminish, or is it exacerbated by, say, like mild stage dementia or Alzheimer's?
Well, you're asking a great question because it's not one that has been answered in the scientific literature. There's only a handful of papers that have actually looked at ADHD in the elderly. I'm fascinated about this issue. In fact, I'm starting a research project now. We're trying to get funded for a big research project to look at ADHD in the elderly. We've done some initial studies that show if you have ADHD, you're more likely to show signs of minor cognitive impairment. You're more likely to get diagnosed later on with a dementia or with Alzheimer's disease or another form of dementia. And we think it's possible that there is some kind of interaction between the risk for ADHD and the risk for these dementias. That is, I should emphasize, it's a small increase in risk. When I say increase in the risk, it's not big, but it's real.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not sure. We're looking at the treatment effects that we haven't even looked at yet. But it's a fascinating area of inquiry.
Absolutely. I kind of suspected that there was a correlation, so I will be very interested to follow up as you research to find out what the findings truly are. Very, very interesting. Wow, this is so fascinating to me. Thank you for this. I know we've kind of wandered around and touched on a lot, but is there anything that we missed that you feel important to bring up today?
Well, one point I'll make is that there are people who've been studying the neurobiology of ADHD for many years. Initially, it was thought many, many years ago this was like a problem with parents, bad parenting, or bad teachers. But we've really come to understand a few things. One, there's very strong evidence of a very notable genetic component. The biggest risk factor we know of for developing ADHD is if you have an identical twin with ADHD. Your genome is identical to someone else's genome who has ADHD, your risk is very high. And in fact, we can compute a statistic called heritability, which says that ADHD is about 70%, 75% heritable, which is almost as much as schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, autism, making it one of the more heritable disorders in psychiatry. Recently, a group of us, including myself, have been conducting what are called genome-wide association studies. And this year we'll publish the discovery of the first set of genes that are implicated in ADHD. We know there's a strong underlying genetic component for ADHD. That's really just hot off the press and very important news for the ADHD world. We believe that these genes express themselves in the brain and that there's some abnormalities of brain functioning that are leading to the behaviors that we call ADHD. We don't really understand the brain circuits very well, but we do have many, many neuroimaging studies that are showing small but real changes in the brain that probably explain why people have ADHD. So again, it's not a disorder of bad parenting, it's not a disorder of lazy people. It's a disorder of the brain that's a little unusual, but not dramatically so. So when I say the brain's unusual, if you went in for a scan by your doctor, if they do a MRI scan of my brain, they wouldn't find any problems because they're all very small problems that we only see with intensive research examination with hundreds of patients in our protocol. Mm-hmm. But just, that's the main thing I would add to our current discussion is people should understand that this is a disorder that is certainly affected by environment as well, but has a strong genetic component and has its locus of pathophysiology in the brain.
Okay. Something good to know so that if you know that that's in your family, something to keep an eye out with future generations. Very, very interesting. Well,
absolutely.
Yeah. So as we begin to wrap up, I mentioned your website. Is this where folks need to go to learn more about ADHD?
Yeah. So we have the website is for training primary care doctors, primary care personnel, physicians, nurses, physician assistants on how to screen, diagnose, and treat ADHD. There's also information for patients. Patients can also go to our YouTube site where we have lots of videos that are introductory videos about ADHD. And they'll also benefit from the blogs and the website where we talk about a number of ongoing issues in adult ADHD.
Yes, as I mentioned before, your website is very rich in information, so I really encourage folks to head over there, ADHDinAdults.com. Well, as we wrap up then, any final words of advice?
Just for people with ADHD, not to lose hope for their people in their family, their spouses, partners, to have a better understanding of this is a real disorder, this is not a lazy person or a bad person, and that they ought to work together to maintain a good treatment program to get them back on track, because it is, ADHD is one of the most treatable disorders we have in psychiatry. It's just a question of keeping that treatment on track. Yeah, maintaining the hope.
You got it. Hope is what it's all about, folks. Head over to ADHDinAdults.com. Dr. Stephen Ferrone, thank you so much for this enlightening conversation today. I know you've helped me out personally. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Pat. It was good talking to you.
Listen to Pat Rulo and Speak Up and Stay Alive Radio. Stay safe from little-known healthcare and hospital hazards. To learn more, go to speakupandstayalive.com. That's speakupandstayalive.com.
Are you looking for a speaker for your next event who's fun, fast-paced, enlightening, and did I mention life-saving? Then you need me, Pat Rulo, healthcare safety expert, patient advocate, and radio host. Visit speakupandstayalive.com or call 440-725-5462. Stay safe from little-known healthcare and hospital hazards. Call 440-725-5462 or visit speakupandstayalive.com.